Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Welcome to this week's episode of Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name is Kirk Chisholm, and I'm going to be your host. Today, we have a favorite money manager of mine, Meb Faber. How are you doing today, Meb?
What's up, man? Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, glad to have you on. This is an exciting show for me. I'm a huge fan of one of Meb's favorite styles here, which we're going to talk about today. But before we get to that, let's hear from our sponsor. While preparing for today's episode, I took a look at one of Meb's ETFs using my favorite investment research tool, YCharts. I wanted to compare Meb's ETF, the Cambria Shareholder Yield with symbol SYLD, against a similar fund you may be familiar with, the Vanguard High Dividend Yield ETF. YCharts helped me find something pretty interesting in my research. If I look at the top holdings of SYLD, one that sticks out is Xerox. YChart shows me that it has a current dividend yield of 2.7%. Now, if I look at the top holdings of the Vanguard ETF, one of the holdings that sticks out is ExxonMobil. Now, ExxonMobil has a dividend yield of 4.6%. So I wondered, why would Meb choose Xerox over Exxon? So being the data geek that I am, I use YCharts to plot both companies' dividend yield and shareholder yield. And I saw that Xerox, which made it to the SYLD over Exxon, despite having half the dividend yield, has a shareholder yield of 16.5% compared to Exxon's 4.6%. Meb was right. The net return of capital to shareholders was higher with Xerox than Exxon. This quick analysis of two funds using YCharts demonstrated that value investors shouldn't let high dividend yields blind them to what truly matters. So in my opinion, shareholder yield is way to go. I've included some of these charts showing all of this in the show notes. So if you're a data geek like I am, then you're going to want to go there to check it out. YCharts made this research very easy for me. This would have taken me hours before to do this kind of research. Now I can do it in just a few clicks. So if you're an investor, you should try it out. Visit go.ycharts.com/moneytree. If you want to start your free trial and mention MoneyTree, you'll receive 20% off if you sign up in the next month. That's 20% off if you mention MoneyTree. Visit go.ycharts.com/moneytree. All right, Meb. Well, great to have you on the show today. Meb, maybe you can tell us a little bit about your background because you have a very interesting background, which I think is maybe a little bit different from most money managers.
Ski bum. I was a ski bum, Lake Tahoe. Anyway, yeah, I was an engineer, biotech guy by training, by study undergrad, and fully expected to do that for some sort of career in bioengineering, or as you can recall, and listeners, back in the late 90s, early 2000s was a pretty exciting time in biotech and sequencing the genome. Fast forward 20 years later, we're still starting to see just the beginning of a lot of developments there and understanding all that has to do with those discoveries. But back then, I figured I'd be a scientist. But if you remember, it was also a really exciting time in the markets. 1999, December 31st. Didn't end the world with everything going on. So kind of did end with U.S. stock returns for a long time because that was really the end of the big internet bubble, also in biotech. I was definitely distracted. I don't know if that's the right word, by the financial markets, lured, seduced, worked for a little bit as a biotech stock analyst, and then just kept gravitating more and more towards the financial markets and quantish part of the world and further away from traditional biotech, and my old hobby is now my career and vice versa.
I love your background because you definitely have more of an engineering background, a numbers kind of background, and now you've become a quant. Is that how you'd characterize your investing style?
Sort of a quant light, because I like to distinguish a lot of people when they hear quant, they assume it means like high frequency trading and everything else. But I like to just for it to mean rules-based sort of ideas and construction, really getting the emotions out of there.
So why did you pick that approach versus what other people do? Is it maybe more fundamental or technical?
I feel like the way most people do it is really just kind of bumble around in the dark. So to me as a quant, you know, I think everyone arrives at their own philosophy over time. And for me, it was very much by making all the mistakes that most of us make, not just in financial markets, but also in life with all the behavioral biases we've learned that we've inherited from not only our grandparents, but great, 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 great grandparents too. And natural selection, certainly on the plains with tigers and lions and everything else, is a little different than trading shares of IBM and wheat futures and everything else. So I'm certainly overconfident. I'll take as much risk as you can give me and go on down the line with all the various behavioral biases. So I learned, thankfully, when I didn't have very much money in my 20s, that I did have all these biases. And so for me, it was a slow pilgrimage to learning how to institute rules the same way that people on a diet are trying to not eat pizza and beer every meal of the day, that having some rules and parameters and systems in place seems to be a lot more thoughtful idea for me as a way to invest versus the opposite, which is letting your emotions run unchecked, which often can introduce a lot of fractures in the whole process of and goals of trying to invest in the best way possible.
You know, if you're talking about quant investing, you're talking about having setting up rules. And I think a lot of people think they're setting up rules many times. Maybe they're not. How do you implement the rules and stay within the rules? Because I know sometimes from being an investor, probably as long as you have, sometimes you mess up. Sometimes you break your rules and you don't mean to, and you come up with a mental excuse of, oh, well, it hit my stop loss, but it looks like it's going to turn right here. And then you just keep going. So how do you reinforce those rules so that you don't end up breaking them?
This is at the heart of it all, right? How do you enforce the rule that you shouldn't at 10 p.m. open the fridge or the cabinet and go eat 12 chocolate chip cookies, because you understand that that's probably not going to benefit you in the long term, despite how fun and delicious it may be to eat the cookies and trade shares of Uber and any other exciting security, cryptocurrencies, et cetera. It's having that realization. I think the important part, at least for me, is framing it in a way that takes away that urge and seduction to gamble or muck around with it. An example would be, I'm a huge proponent of automated investing strategies, where a lot of these platforms now, whether it's Vanguard or Betterment, have the ability to do automated trading. So it just kind of whirs in the background and you don't think about it. Another example that historically has been beneficial to a lot of investors is target date funds. Our older generation, which the younger one doesn't have as much, it would have been defined benefit pension plans, where all of these would have been framed under this banner of retirement and savings rather than exciting investing. And so if you're thinking and having sympathy with yourself that's 10, 20, 50 years older, when you frame it in terms of savings and retirement, I think we think about it differently than we would, here's my brokerage account. I think setting up a system to where it's also kind of boring. You lose interest. You know, I'm only probably a huge outlier in that I put the vast majority of my investing assets in the public markets in just one fund. And I don't know hardly anyone else that would do that. But for me, it just simplifies everything to a way that I don't even have to think about it. So I think just having rules isn't necessarily helpful. You know, your rule could be, hey, I'm going to run 10 miles a day and eat salads and smoothies at every meal. But if there's no chance of success with that, it's going to be a lot harder. So framing it and setting up in a way where you maximize your chance of success. And for many people, by the way, that's a written plan. And for others, it's also sharing that plan with someone who's going to keep you in compliance, whether it's a spouse or children or neighbor. It's a lot more embarrassing to be eating pizza and drinking beer on the couch sitting next to a spouse when they know that your plan is not to do that. So I think all those things are important. The actual rules part about it is not necessarily the most important. It's just, can you come up with a plan? And for many people, by the way, that's having an advisor. Having someone in between you and doing something really foolish is certainly a potential good outcome for people that would rather think that on their own, they would make big mistakes.
That's really important, having those protections, an advisor being one of them or whatever it might be, but having those things that you can't necessarily manipulate yourself and come up with exceptions to those rules. I know that there are a lot of quant investors out there and, you know, they're all different in their approaches, but I know that you're really into the data. That's something that you do a lot of research on. And what have you found to be one of the better strategies out there when it comes to the quant approach as you back test and look at what works and what doesn't?
Oh man, there's a million. Everything works when you look back in history, right? You can come up with almost any crystal ball, fantastic strategy looking back in history. I think it's really important to have a respect for history. So the more data, the better. I think it's wonderful to look back. My favorite investing book, we talk a lot about Triumph of the Optimists, expensive book. That's probably $100 on Amazon, but a beautiful coffee table book that looks at the history of financial markets, not just in the US, because the US has been a phenomenal outlier for the past 120 years, but also all the other countries in the world, whether it's China and Russia, whose capital markets shut down at one point. If you were a stock investor, you lost all your money to other markets that went through booms and busts and other periods where the best performing market, I think, over the last 120 years was South Africa, but the worst, excluding the ones that went to zero, perhaps Austria, where you made really no money on the stock market. You know, having appreciation for history, and even then having an appreciation that, hey, 120 years actually isn't that much. And you can go back into the 19th century, but even then things start to get even a little weirder to base your decisions off. So almost any investing strategy or approach needs to be rooted in some sort of common sense understanding of how the world works or of how investments should work. And even then having a little bit of a comedian smile and approach the markets to where you say, you know what, at some point there's going to be things that don't look like the past. I think if you went and surveyed a bunch of professors 15 years ago and said a large portion of the world is going to have negative yielding bonds, they would have all laughed and kicked you out of class, probably give you an F on the midterm. Having an appreciation for history, understanding that things will be different. So that's all the foundation. That having been said, to actually answer your question now, and the two big ones for me, the two pillars that I think really have withstood the test of time that are pretty different, but also have been around for over 100 years, are ones that go back to the time of Ben Graham and also Charles Dow of the early 20th century, which is the concepts of value investing and also trend or its cousin momentum investing. I think both of those are strategies that over time certainly have done well and will continue to do well in the future.
One of the things that from our industry, a lot of things come down to perspective. I've seen these measures put out by some of these firms like growth and value and how they performed over time. And it's always relative, right? I mean, value has been out of favor for the last 10 years. And so growth has outperformed in many ways. But how do you judge it? Because you're just looking at a point in time, because the most recent performance obviously is going to have the most heavy weight if you're, let's just say the growth has been outperforming for 10 years and it may be skewing on one side versus the other. But how do you keep that all into perspective?
We used to tell people when they would ask us questions about markets and asset classes and strategies, and they would say, hey, Meb, how long should I give this? I invested in one of your funds or someone else's and it's been 3 months and it's not doing so good. And I would say for any one asset class strategy or approach, I used to say 10 years and now I say 20. And people laugh and they scoff and they think I'm kidding. And I say, no, I'm not kidding, because you can look back in history. Let's take the most basic one, stocks versus bonds. Stocks for the long run, right? Everyone knows that stocks outperform bonds over time, but they go through very long periods of decades and decades where stocks don't outperform bonds. And that surprises a lot of people, but you can go very long periods. And unless you plan on living to 200 years old, you might, some of the younger people listen to this at this point, but if you're going to live normal life expectancy in the US, that's an entire investing lifetime where one of the most fundamental truths in our world of stocks outperforming bonds may not exist. That may not be something you count on for your entire investing lifetime. So in a world where that's kind of crazy to think about, worrying about, hey, emerging markets underperformed last year or value or whatever the style may be, I think is one of the biggest problems that results in poor behavior in the investing world, which is most people say they have a long-term horizon, but really operate on time frame of months and quarters and years when they should be operating on really decades. What you find out of favor, a perfect example I love to talk about right now, most people really aren't interested in emerging markets. They underperform massively over the past 10 years versus the US stock market, which has really been the darling, outperforming everything. But people forget, if you look at the prior decade, 2000, 2009, emerging markets destroyed US stocks. Everyone wanted emerging markets in the mid-2000s. The BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China. But how quickly we all forget how short our memory is. But we like to come to the conclusion and say it's most important for investors to be asset class agnostic, or the parallel would be strategy agnostic. You talk to everyone and they're, hey, I'm a dividend guy, or I'm an income investor, that's my style, or I do whatever it may be. When in reality, I'm a gold bug, crypto fan, you know, all those have their time in the sun and they have their time where they do very, very poorly. Same thing applies to strategies like value or trend. They certainly go through regime shifts. And that's really what sets the stage, where the good times don't always last and the darkness eventually turns to sunrise. So what we like to do and advise people is certainly to put enough bets out there across various asset classes and strategies so that your portfolio should have a good chance of performing in really most or any market environment.
One of the things that I find challenging and interesting on your take on this is, you know, back in 2008, we were doing a study on the market and it was kind of interesting. But, you know, as I'm sure you know, the correlations of everything pretty much was the same in 2008. Everything performed the same except for gold and cash pretty much. But when the markets are dropping now, everything correlates. But when it's normal or normal-ish, things tend to have a more predictable correlation. So do you see any sort of solutions to this? Because I guess the underwater correlations tends to be a problem, whereas the normal times are maybe not operating. They're operating normally, but the times of the drawdown is probably the thing. That's what everyone worries.
We wrote a paper on tail risk and talking about what happens when the worst periods for U.S. stocks, which if you only go back to the 80s, you know, you look at the top 10 or 20 worst months and the average is like minus 10. So, you know, investors, I hope you're not listening to this over lunch, but think about the stock market dropping 10% next month. It makes people queasy, but that's kind of a normal outcome. And so we said, what do other asset classes do? How do they behave on average? What's the batting average? Do they diversify in those months? And if so, by how much? And the things that you would expect not to diversify, foreign stocks, real estate, didn't. They did just as bad, if not worse, than U.S. stocks. The things that you would expect to help, bonds or cash, certainly did. It's not guaranteed. And then there's some others that are kind of random. So gold on average helps, but there was one month that stocks went down 10 and gold went down 17. So we say, yes, there's trends. Yes, there's echoes of history, but you can't ever guarantee it or count on it. And then there's some active strategies, which not surprisingly, likely will continue to do well. Managed futures or trend following is certainly one. Obviously, buying puts or tail risk hedge would be one, but that's a cost in other times. You know, we often say that diversification helps, but you should also never assume that it's going to. And the environment which we find ourselves in now, which we often say that we think U.S. stocks are priced for subpar returns going forward, so low single digit returns in the 2020s, but bonds, you know, I don't know how much you can count on or expect treasuries to really diversify when you're getting down to these low yielding. I mean, it's weird to say, but the U.S. is actually a high yielding bond market around the world, around the sovereigns. The U.S. is what, I don't know, 1.8% now versus a lot of the sovereigns around the world being negative. It's nice to try to think about having strategies and asset classes diversify, but you can't count on it. But being thoughtful about it is certainly a good step in compliance and how you behave and what to expect.
When I hear that a lot of these presentations are talking about diversification through assets, do you think it might be a better way to diversification through strategies versus assets? Do you think that may be a more improved way to look at MPT?
Yes and no. And I'll give an example. So, you know, I think the starting point for almost everyone is the global market portfolio. If you just went out and bought the entire world of all the public assets in the world, you end up with a portfolio that's roughly half stocks, half bonds, and of that, half US and half foreign. And most people are woefully already way away from that. The vast majority of people put the vast majority of their money in the US, in US stocks, and all the other countries around the world, they put it in their own market. Same thing for bonds. And that's this major sort of home country bias. So for the first part, can you get a diversified portfolio of global assets? Yes, but most people don't. And while that's been fine in the US this past decade, I guarantee if you ask anyone from Brazil, Greece, Russia, Turkey, that hasn't been a great idea, certainly for the past decade. So once you have that foundation and base case, are there things you can do that I think are additive? Sure. I think value is an important one because there's times when just buying assets at any price is not a great idea, and having some sort of fundamental anchor to which you can judge, hey, does the world look reasonable or rational, I think is really important. Otherwise, late 90s, you'd be buying stocks at 45 times price to earnings. Now, is that something that any of us would say is a reasonable thing to do? No. And same thing in Japan. In the 80s, they hit a P/E ratio of almost 100. And then one of the reasons they've had horrible investing returns for the three decades that followed was because they got into the biggest bubble we've ever seen. And on the flip side, just when everything looks bleakest, looking at some of these stock markets, having a value approach and saying, hey, that's a stock market that trades at a PE ratio of 7. Is the world still ending there, or is it maybe an opportunity? So I think having some common sense is really helpful. The good news is most of the world, I think, looks pretty reasonably priced right now to downright cheap. It just happens to not be the US, who is one of the more expensive markets, but not crazy and not a bubble. And so having a value approach, I think, is really thoughtful. And then you've known me for long enough to know that we're pretty much an outlier on this philosophy, but I believe in trend following as an idea or allocation to add to a portfolio. We're probably the biggest outlier of anyone in the country. We offer, we call Trinity portfolios, which is roughly half in buy and hold asset allocation with tilts towards value. I think that's a great way to manage money. But the problem with buy and hold for most people is they really struggle with the drawdowns. They struggle with the global financial crisis, just not doing anything when everything goes down. And so a strategy that's been around for over 100 years is trend following, which is you're trying to be invested during the up markets and trying to exit to the safety of cash or bonds or whatever your safe asset may be when markets are declining, has a long, great history. The challenge is it's also not an easy strategy to follow because you often look different when other people are making hay. So when the S&P may be romping, you may be underperforming, or it may struggle in sideways markets. But when markets, particularly US stocks, go through a long drawdown, which happens often in the 2000s and 2010s, you know, we had two bear markets that essentially lost half, but that's nothing compared to the Great Depression, which lost almost 90. So having trend following is one that is a nice sort of yin-yang to buy and hold. We call it Trinity portfolios. So we put half in buy and hold and the other half in trend following strategies is a great behavioral hack to try to keep yourself in the game. So you always have one foot in the buy and hold world. So you're always not too different from everyone else. But at the same time, if it ever hits the fan and you have another financial crisis or something similar, hopefully you'll be out of those markets if they continue to decline 20, 40, 60, 80, 90%. So for me, that is a strategy we've sort of arrived at that's holistic and that I think most people can really comply with that makes a lot of sense. But that's sort of a combination of everything. It's diversification across asset classes. It's diversification across strategies like momentum and trend and value and diversification across geography. So it's kind of the, our worldview of trying to put it all into one holistic strategy. And when I referenced it in the beginning, that's what I do with my own money.
And I love the fact you came out with the Trinity portfolios because I've been following that for a while. And one of the biggest challenges people have, because so much of the return comes from allocation, and there's just so much of an art to it, you might argue, because you're a data guy and you might say, well, it's more science than art. But the reality is that because so much of it comes from that, and I find that so many different companies, they pick and choose, they come up with their own versions of it, which may be more cherry picking than actual data. Yeah, I find it's a difficult challenge, especially now where everything is, I mean, we could argue valuations, but in my opinion, everything is across the board is a bit expensive, except for, as you said, emerging markets, which I think GMO does a good 7-year analysis on markets. I mean, that was quite high. Emerging markets and emerging value, I think, were in 6 to 7% expected annual range, but everything else was negative. Is that correct?
Emerging markets are an area that we certainly are big proponents of for the next decade. The average US investor of their stock allocation only has like 5-6% in emerging markets when it should be double or triple that. And most people seem to forget that emerging market as a percentage of the world has most of the GDP. It's got most of the people. It's got most of the growth. When you combine with that, with the fact that the emerging markets are also cheap and underowned, it's a really beautiful, ideal investment. Now, they're still stocks. So if the US market goes down 50, would I expect the emerging markets not to go down 50? I wouldn't. They very well could go down 50 or more. But there is a large margin of safety. Historically speaking, quantitatively speaking, you're much better off investing in countries that are cheap than expensive. And investing in the most expensive countries historically has led to big fat losses in the next 3 to 5 years. And the US has avoided that for the most part this past decade, which we may get on the books as the first decade ever without a recession. I mean, it's been a long time since we've had a bear too. So we'll see how it plays out. But the romping, stomping bull in the US has certainly been unstoppable for this decade. But I like to tease people on Twitter. I said I put my whole 401k in emerging market stocks and just dollar cost average in. And I'm really happy with that. As a long-term perspective, I think they'll do much better in the coming decade.
And one thing I've noticed about emerging markets, they tend to be good for trend following. Like they trend well. They trend strongly, I guess I would put it, in that when they're doing well, they do extremely well. And when they do poorly, they're extremely poor. I think the hard part is a lot of people, at least what I've found from talking to clients, is a lot of people are still stuck in this buy and hold mentality because that's what they've been told. That's what they've learned for the last 30 years, and that's what's worked. And I don't know that I necessarily buy that mentality because it works when things are going up. You know, if you looked at 2000 to 2012, I think it was, you would have had like a negative 0.3% annualized over that period. You pretty much just lost 13 years of your time. So buy and hold doesn't always work. But I think emerging markets it's scary for a lot of people. Do you have a kind of a simple way for people to kind of look at emerging markets?
I think a big one for investors is to get away from the seduction of thinking in terms of any one position or asset class. So looking at your portfolio holistically, you know, this big bowl of soup where you put all these ingredients in, no one is just going to pull out the carrot and be like, oh my God, these, you know, carrots are really ruining the soup, but really see it as this holistic view of the world and realize that that's sort of the whole point of diversification. You look at your account statement, you should hope that something is zigging and zagging. Say, man, you know, gold's not doing well this month, or bonds or stocks, or why? Every client that's looking at their returns over the past 1, 3, 5 years, 10 years are asking their advisors, why do we own emerging markets at all? This is crazy. The US is the only place to be, when how quickly we all forget. And when we do this podcast in 2029, which will probably be a hologram video at that point, you know, and we talk about the decade in review, it shouldn't be surprising if other assets had great returns. And that's just the nature and cycle of markets. And the U.S. is very rarely the best performing market. It almost never happens just because there's so many countries around the world. But certainly, look, I'm a huge proponent of investing in U.S. stocks. And that's why we have such a massive position in U.S. stocks as a percentage of the globe. You know, the default is half. But most people in the U.S. put 70 or 80%. So they're putting a massive, massive active bet on U.S. stocks, whether they know it or not. And most don't. Most think probably should just have 80% in U.S. stocks. But that's a very strong bet. So if you've had that on, pat yourself on the back, celebrate, drink some champagne this New Year's. And then Jan 1, sober up and realize that the Vanguard John Bogle index starting point is you should have half in the rest of the world. And most people don't, because it feels uncomfortable. But I think that concentrating in any one country is a really, really foolish idea.
I want to talk about two kind of concepts that you talk about a lot, which I really wanted to kind of dig into a little bit today. And one of them is the shareholder yield concept. I read about this a number of years ago from, I think it was O'Shaughnessy's book, What Works on Wall Street, which talks about, I don't know, 15, 16 different investment philosophies and how they performed. It's a huge book. It's like an encyclopedia. But it was fascinating that, to me, out of all of the strategies, seemed to be the best of what he found. Hey, what are your thoughts on shareholder yield? But also, can you kind of talk a little bit about it and what it means? Because I find this concept fascinating.
We spoke earlier about having a fundamental foundational worldview of why strategies work. So at its very core, investing in stocks is simply investing in companies and businesses. And to get returns from businesses, eventually you need them to pay you out of their cash flows, whether historically that's been dividends, and why investors and retirees love dividends so much. They feel like they're getting a check in the mail, or the company has to grow and the value of the company increases. And so, but eventually you need to realize that value somehow. So whether you sell the company or the stock, or you get the cash flows, same thing as investing in stocks. And so there's really only 5 things a company can do with its cash, and there's nothing else. They can reinvest in the business, which is what most people get excited about because that's the sexy part. They can do mergers or acquisitions, so empire build, go buy other companies. They can pay down debt if they have any. They can pay out dividends to their shareholders, or they can buy back stock. That's it. 5 things they can do, and that's it. And there's other things that fall under those categories. You call R&D is under reinvesting in the business. Historically speaking, if you're investing in a stock or a business, what you want is a company that's profitable and making boatloads of money and sloughing off a bunch of cash to the shareholders and then distributing it. And so one of the biggest takeaways from investing that is really hard for people is distinguishing between a situation where they say something like, this time is different, in believing that markets are just different. So a good example would be, hey, US stocks always outperform emerging markets. And that's what people are extrapolating from the last 10 years. And then also taking a step back and say, okay, wait, actually, is something really changed? Is there a fundamental
or structural shift that I need to be aware of. And so in the case of investing in stocks, particularly in the US, there was, and this was in the early 1980s, there were some rules that passed that gave companies safe harbor, made it a little more clear about buying back stock and made it a little easier. And a lot of people get this wrong. Almost every politician loves to get this wrong. And legislators and journalists and commentators. In general, Finance 101, if you're in college, you learn that dividends and buybacks are essentially the same thing. Now, if you're ignoring taxes, of course, but really what you're doing is returning cash to shareholders. And Warren Buffett certainly understands this, as do others. And they're doing it through a different route. So buybacks are more tax efficient than dividends are, because dividends, you're forced to take the distribution and whether you want it or not, and then you have to pay taxes on it if you're a taxable investor. But historically, dividends have been a great thing. And the reason that dividend paying stocks and high yielding stocks have outperformed is because you get a slight value tilt to the portfolio. But in the 1980s, that changed so that more companies now in any given year, going back to the 1990s, actually pay out more in buybacks than they do in dividends. So it really makes no sense whatsoever to look at one or the other in isolation. So this makes no sense to just look at dividends or just look at buybacks, when in reality, and it's important, by the way, to look at net buybacks, because companies issue stock too. So the last thing you want is a company issuing a ton of shares just to pay for options to their executives and then buy back stock with the other hand, when in reality, you have no net difference in shares outstanding. So what we really like to look for, and this shows up in the data, is a holistic approach to where you want to be investing in companies that are paying out their cash flows through either dividends or net buybacks or both. And a great example has been Apple, where if you're just focusing on dividends or just focusing on buybacks, you're missing half the picture because they do a great deal of both. But once you look at them holistically, and we also like to apply a value filter, because we don't want companies that are expensive paying dividends or buying back their stock, but really want cheap ones. And what we said about Buffett earlier, echoing, you know, he says there's no better use of a company's cash flow than if they're trading below intrinsic value to buy back the stock. So the shareholder yield concept is you're looking at dividends as well as net buybacks and companies that are trading for low valuations. And that's really kind of a trifecta of a great way to think about investing in stocks. And it turns out, you know, we wrote a free book on this. And listeners, if you're still here, you can go to our website and download it for free, cambriainvestments.com. We have three of our books up there for free. At least historically, it's been a fantastic way to invest. It's outperformed the broad markets as well as any dividend strategy you can come up with. And then you reference Jim O'Shaughnessy's Bible, What Works on Wall Street. That takes it back to the 1920s. And part of the beauty of the strategy is not just that you're investing in companies that are paying out their cash flow, you're also avoiding ones that are issuing shares and diluting you as a shareholder. So it's really just kind of beautiful and simple strategy. It works well in the US. It works just as well, if not more, in foreign markets and emerging, where it's important. A lot of emerging markets, for example, you have a lot of these state-owned enterprises. You have a lot of companies that are just these massive market cap weighted stocks that may not be the most shareholder friendly companies you actually want. So I think it's a great philosophy, one that I think there's a lot of opportunity that the marketplace hasn't really realized the full potential of this yet. Still, almost everyone wants to invest in dividends because I think they have a great story and a great narrative brand. But in reality, if you take a step back and think about it, doesn't make a whole lot of sense. That was the short answer to your very simple question.
I think it's great. And I think it's important to understand the concept, because it took me a while to kind of understand it. Once I did, I was like, oh, this is brilliant. Have you thought about incorporating other stuff into the process? Because I know you use this with a lot of your strategies at your firm. Like, you had Chris Mayer on a while ago, and I've followed him for years with his owner-operator. He has a few different things that he looks at, but he incorporates the owner-operator piece as being important, which the owners tend to do better for their company than CEOs who have very little percentage of ownership. So have you thought about incorporating that or any other factors into your process?
I've thought about it all. And I say that laughingly, is that you can kind of come up with almost infinite variations on how to design a quantitative portfolio. And there's always a fine balance between what I think makes sense, what people actually want, and where the Venn diagrams overlap. And for me, you know, I invest the vast majority of my money in our own funds. And listeners, by the way, most mutual funds don't, which is a surprise to a lot of people, that most managers don't actually invest. Not only do they not invest a lot, they don't invest at all in their own funds, which is a little crazy. We try to design things here that we want to invest in and that makes sense. So we kind of put our best foot forward on what we think actually works. That having been said, do I think there's sort of infinite variants that are fine and that make a lot of sense? I do. You mentioned the execs or the leadership having skin in the game or high ownership or whether it's a family business. I mean, there's so many different indicators and they all give you different exposures and tilts. An example would be, you know, hey, is it better to invest in high quality or low volatility, high balance sheet? And so many of these things, it sort of falls under the category of I'm somewhat agnostic. It's very clear. If you've been listening at this point, you'll realize there's lots of things that I'm very opinionated about. And there's some where I'm just somewhat agnostic. And so a lot of the other factors, it's neither here nor there for me. The big muscle movement in the first place is that you're moving away from market cap weighting and using value, and in this case, cash flows at all. And once you make these huge decisions, which probably gets you 90% of the way there to the 10-yard line, there's a million other things you can do that kind of turn the dial at the very end. But the big, huge muscle movement is the decision to use value in the first place, which, you know, kind of puts you in an entirely different galaxy already.
I want to touch on the value part as well, because I know you're really a big fan of the CAPE ratio as a measure of value, because I think the term value, it's like saying growth versus value. I can't tell you how many people ask, what's the difference between growth and value? And I guess it depends on your perspective, but how do you look at value and how do you measure it? And what do you find is most effective?
I think value is a blunt tool, but a great one. And one that I actually don't think the specific indicator matters that much. And I'll give you an example. If you look at US stock market as a whole, you can't find a value indicator that says US stocks are cheap. Now, you mentioned the CAPE ratio, which is nothing more than a 10-year price earnings ratio adjusted for inflation. So that's sitting right around 30. And you know, my point is that if you're looking at it out to two decimals, you're probably doing it wrong, to where you're saying, hey, look, stocks are probably expensive. Doesn't matter if they're a P ratio of 28 or 30 or 32, it doesn't. The question is, are they at 30 or at 7? And most markets and most stocks spend the vast majority of the time being relatively reasonably valued. So most of the countries around the world are pretty reasonable, but flows and emotions cause countries to get to extremes. And the expensive stuff is usually markets that are hitting all-time highs where everything looks rosy. Look at the US. No recession in the past decade. 2017 was the first year in history where the stock market went up every single month, on and on and on, right? But if you look at somewhere like Turkey or any number of these other countries, look what's going on in Hong Kong and China. It's not as good of an example anymore, but two of the cheapest markets, Russia and Greece, total basket cases 3, 4, 5 years ago. But you fast forward now, and I think Russia is up 30% this year and Greece is up 50%. So when things go from being merely not horrifically terrible to slightly less worse, less bad, you can get really bad returns. So the whole point of my mind is, are you in the right sort of ballpark? And most of the countries that are in the low single digit P ratios, so I think Russia's and Turkey are the only two right now that are single digit. So we track about 45 countries. There's a few frontier markets that are probably in that bucket too, like Argentina. But those markets, things usually look terrible, horrible economies. Brazil was going through essentially their own depression this past decade. On top of that, they're doing terrible things geopolitically, and the stock market is usually, and this is the big driver of the P and the PE, stock market's already down 40, 60, 80, 90%. So if you look at a basket of these cheap countries, on average, they're probably down by half, whereas the basket of the expensive stuff is probably hitting new highs. And so you have this scenario where tilting towards value is a smart thing to do. It's a little scary, which is why you want to buy a basket. Our largest fund does this, where it goes and buys a basket of the 12 cheapest countries. So you're not just buying one, but also, I think this is really important to note, is that part of the whole benefit of using value, yes, it's all well and good that you're buying the cheap stuff, but it's also important that you're avoiding the expensive. So avoiding the really stupid decisions to invest in countries when they're trading at 40, 60, 80, 90 price earnings ratios, which if you're just an index investor, you'll end up doing at some point. In the US, again, it's not horrific. I don't think it's a bubble and has to crash, but I do think that the returns will be a drag on future returns. And Bogle himself said this before he passed. He says, you know, he expected US stocks to do low single digits for the next 10 years. Going back to our earlier discussion about how much you allocate to the US, for most people listening in the US who allocate 80% to one of the most expensive markets in the world, is that a great idea? I would argue it's not, despite how comfortable it feels.
I appreciate that perspective, and we got to wrap it up here, and I wanted to give you a chance for any kind of final thoughts. And
come on, man. I got all day. I thought this was just the intro. We're just getting warmed up. We haven't even talked about a million other ideas. No, I think holistically, the most important thing for any investor, and this is hard, it sounds simple, but it's really hard advice, is finding an investment approach that works for you. And being mindful in 2019 that we live in a world where you can implement that very tax efficiently at very low cost. But for a lot of the younger investors in particular, you know, having not been through various market cycles and just assuming that your portfolio is going to return 10%+ every year and you don't have any of the scars yet, it's hard to tell people, hey, it's easy to have this investing approach because you haven't been through it, the real pain of losing 10, 20, 30, 40, 50% of your account. And that's really hard. But I think eventually trying to be mindful of finding the approach that works for you, whatever that may be, is really a key takeaway of this whole discussion.
And I guess one final question, what is your favorite asset class?
If you say MEB, Desert Island, Gunderhead, when we check back in 2020s, my favorite asset class would be, and depending on the criteria of this contest question, if it had to be geography, it would be emerging markets. If it had to be a philosophy, it would be deep value investing in the global markets right now, because I think you can get a P ratio of the cheapest stock markets. You get a basket of about P ratio of about 10, which historically the average is 16, 17, and the US is at 30 today. So it's trading at somewhere between 50 and two-thirds discount to the US market, 50%, two-thirds discount. If you were to say an investing strategy, you like how I answered this three different ways.
Yep.
Trend following. You know, trend following to me is the ultimate don't know what the future holds idea. So that would be my portfolio as a whole. I got out of this with three different answers, but depending on what you meant by that question, all three would be totally fine with me.
This has been great, Meb. I appreciate you coming on the show, and I know our listeners are going to learn a lot from this. Where can people find more about you?
Everywhere. The internet has got us plastered everywhere. We got a blog at mebfavor.com. We have my day job, which is managing Cambria Investment Management. So that's cambriainvestments.com. And then if you want to find out about our funds, we manage about $1 billion in assets across 12 ETFs and other strategies. That's cambriafunds.com. Also got a podcast. And if you want to watch me pick fights on Twitter, that's at Meb Favor. We just started throwing up a few videos on YouTube. And if you find yourself in Los Angeles, Manhattan Beach, El Segundo, come say hello. That's where our world headquarters is.
All right. Well, that was a great interview with Meb Favor. I love talking to Meb. I could probably talk to him all day, but in the interest of time, we're going to bring on our panel portion of the show here. So this week we have Megan Gorman. How are you doing today, Megan?
Hi, Kirk. I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well.
And by the way, great interview with Meb. He's a fascinating guest.
Thanks. Well, I give him all the credit because he did most of the talking.
That's okay. That's his job, being a guest.
And we also have Barb Friedberg. How are you doing, Barb?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Well, I'm glad to have you both on because this I love talking about this topic. As I mentioned in the interview, I learned about this topic from reading a book, What Works on Wall Street, which is an encyclopedic book, but it's a great book to really kind of dig into some methodologies that work and don't work. And I think it's more of a numbers-based approach. One thing I want to touch on, and we were talking a little bit before the show, Barb brought up an interesting point about rules-based investing. And, you know, I think the question is that may come up from listeners is what is rules-based investing? So I don't know if Barb, if you want to touch on that.
I would be happy to. Yeah, because it sounded great on the interview, but then I thought, well, what does that actually mean? So in general, rules-based investing refers to understanding the academic research on investing. So what has been found to work, and then creating an investment strategy or style that is based on specific rules. And there's not just one rule. So for example, over time, it's been found that small cap stocks outperform large cap stocks. Now, this isn't over 5 years. This is over like decades. And the same goes for value-based stocks typically outperform growth stocks, contrary to the past 10 years. So when he was talking about rules-based investing, I think you can tell by looking at some of his funds what he means. So he's, for example, has a global momentum ETF. So that's based on momentum rules that state that stocks that are going up typically go up for a particular period of time until there's a catalyst, after which they go down. So then he has another value and momentum ETF, and it combines two strategies. So that's what kind of defines the rule-based idea. And it gives an investor, you can either invest in a rules-based fund, or if you're an individual investor, you can choose the rules and then adhere to them yourself. So it gives your investing a little bit of discipline, which is in fact based on some underlying principles.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. And to maybe to highlight the importance of rule-based investing, you know, Megan, I mean, you work with a lot of clients. And, you know, when it comes to rule-based investing, what do you see as kind of some of the bigger investor psychology pitfalls that people come up with?
What's interesting, I think, with rules-based investing is it's a bigger focus at times on the process around investing. So Barb laid out some of the key tenets we often see with rule-based investing. But I find in working with clients, it's reminding them that it's the process of how they are going to enter the market and stay in the market that's key. And that's because when you deal with a lot of rules-based investing, you are often at times waiting for the premium to kick in, right? So Barb brought up the fact that over the long term, value outperforms growth. We haven't seen that in a while. And trust me, I work with DFA on some of our portfolios. And so you have to have some patience for it.
Very painful.
It's been very painful, right? When you watch the returns. But again, it's sticking to the knitting, right? Which is, okay, the process around this is over the long term. It's working with clients, reminding them of the timeframes in which they are invested for. And, you know, you've got to also factor in when you're talking to clients about investing with a process about things such as longevity. So for anyone today who's in their late 40s, early 50s, there is a significant chance of making it all the way to 90. I believe for women, it's about 30%. And for men, it's about 18%. So when you think about it, and you think about being patient in the marketplace and waiting for these premiums to kick in, you've got to keep in mind that you're going to be in the market for decades. And I think Meb did a really good job of talking about that in context of emerging markets. You know, I think people often look at asset classes like emerging markets as a very, you know, they're expecting it to do something for them in the short term. But it's really a very long-term play on that asset class.
Yeah, and I think that's really important because if you look at emerging markets, it's an interesting asset class. I've always found that they trend strongly, right? Like when they're going well, they're going really well. I mean, it's like the market on steroids, basically, because they do really well. But when they don't do well, they really don't do well. You know, it's not value versus growth investing is a little bit different because they're both a part of, you know, let's say you're using the S&P 500. They're both a part of the S&P 500. You know, there's a value portion, there's a growth portion, and they're kind of two parts to the same whole. I am interested to see when the value portion is going to kick in, though, because that 10 years has been really long for value investors. And I think the time perspective is really interesting, too, because I remember when I was starting in the industry, I was looking at historical data from growth versus value, and, you know, it said basically they were the same. Of course, this is at the peak of the market bubble, which I think was probably a few years before that. But effectively, the rates were close to the same. But that's not always the case. You know, you need to be patient in order to invest in value if it's out of favor. Barb, what are your thoughts on this, on the value investing versus growth?
I'm so glad that you asked me that. I was chuckling as well. Because value has a lot of research behind it that, you know, probably close to 100 years over which long-term periods, value outperforms growth. And just for your listeners, so you understand, well, what the heck is value and growth? Growth is a strategy where when an investment starts, is typically wedded in companies that are growing very quickly. So they have growth rates year over year of 15, 20%. Their stock prices are moving up very quickly and they're on a roll. Value, in other words, you're looking for companies that are priced reasonably by some sort of metric and are not trading above fair value. So it might be a low price to earnings ratio or a low price to sales ratio that will help categorize value investing. So back to your question, based on your research, I have always set up the rules for my personal investing as well as for the portfolios that I've managed in the past and currently manage based on historical data. So given that point, I also lean my portfolios towards value. And for those of you that don't know, the past 10 years has been pretty poor for value as momentum has shown to offer the best returns. And secret, after I listened to that interview with Meb, I went to my main portfolio and I looked at how it was allocated. I just wanted to see, you know, where do I fit in with his hypotheses. And I have a value tilt. I also have a tilt towards international and emerging markets. And so over the past 10 years, my return suffered somewhat because of those positions. Given what Meb said, given what Megan said, and is a really, really important investing premise is you have to be in it for the long term. And I don't mean, you know, 5-10 years. I mean decades. Even someone in their 60s likely will be alive or could very well be alive for another 30 years. So you have to be aware of the history and you have to invest accordingly. I kind of believe that the value makes sense to me intuitively. I don't like overpaying for things, and it makes sense to buy assets either near fair value or on sale. But that doesn't mean that that's going to pay off this year, next year, or within the next 10 years. So you have to have a holistic view and reasonable expectations.
But Barb, that doesn't make it fun on the golf course. That's the challenge, right?
Yeah, right? Because I'm looking at the portion of my portfolio that is invested in the S&P 500, of which, you know, thank goodness I've got a big portion. And that returned like 23% this year. Right. And so, of course, it's going through my mind. Well, if only I had all my assets in that, it would have been awesome. But I don't know about
you. You sound like a client.
I know, but I don't know about you guys, but my crystal ball is not in great working order.
Yeah, I have to tell you what's been really interesting this year, and not to go off on a tangent, but going off what Barb said about the S&P 500, is in showing performance to people, how diversified portfolios have done, even with those with a value tilt, which a lot of my portfolios have. You know, portfolios have done incredibly well this year, and I find investors are very surprised by that. You know, and you have to remind them that this is part of the process and the waiting for the premium and you know, staying in the market despite the fact that emotionally, a lot of them want to go running for the exits. And I think it does go to the fact that having process is so key in this, even though right now, a lot of investors feel apprehensive.
Well, I do want to make one point to what you said, Megan, and it's that people are surprised at their returns. I think the returns are surprising because they're not what people think they are. What I was surprised at is, as we were going through our quarterlies, if you look at the S&P year over year at the end of Q3, it was up, including dividends, 2.9%. And if you take out dividends, it was up like 1.7% or something like that. So if you exclude November, you know, where we had a big spike, the markets were basically sideways for a year and a half. If it wasn't for December falling off the table, you know, this year wouldn't have looked so good. So one of the challenges, I mean, Megan, I'm sure you reiterate this. One of the challenges that we have is putting things in perspective for people, because they might say, wow, you know, the market's up 20 some odd percent. And why am I not up that much? And it's like, well, because you didn't lose 20% last year. And it so happened that the end of the year happened to fall in a time where the market was a lot lower. So it makes this year look great. But it's hard to keep things into perspective, I think, to both of your points. Over the longer term, people want to look at certain points in time. Like January 1st is a point in time that's really important for most people. End of quarter is a point in time that's important. But in the grand scheme of things, it's really not important. because, you know, if you're looking at companies, they're putting out their quarterlies, they have to, everyone's driven by that. But it's a point in time that if it happens to fall in a certain way, it makes you look good or bad. And it, you know, if you take a look at how the market's performing, it's a totally different picture. I don't know, Megan, what are your thoughts on this growth value momentum? Where do you stand in that?
Yeah, we have a significant portion of our portfolios with dimensional funds, which for background for people, dimensional or DFA is basically mutual funds that are based on the academic research of Eugene Fama and Kenneth French that won the Nobel back in the 60s. So it's all about the principles that Barb brought up. Part of the challenges that we have been finding is while portfolios have been up this year, when we actually start to match up different asset classes to their respective indices, we're finding there is some lag. You know, not huge lag, but, you know, 20, 30 basis points. And it's a lot about reminding clients that we are waiting for these premiums to kick in. Now, I think the other thing that we've been seeing a lot of this year is, and it's been a pleasant surprise, is actually fixed income returns. And I don't know how the two of you have felt about watching bond portfolios this year, but it's been nice to see actual return on those portfolios. And that's been actually helpful in having some of the discussions of how do you continue the process in the event of a pullback. And I think one of the things that Meb kept saying, and I think it's very, very true, which is, you know, you need to have process and structure built around things if you're going to go down a path. And I think that that's what he's very good at. So what we work with a lot of the clients on is when we have a pullback, if we start to be overexposed in fixed income, we actually have to clip those additional percentage points and redeploy into equities. That's part of the process we're trying to drive them to and trying to have them understand that in a pullback, that's actually the opportunity we're looking for. It's a little bit of rules-based process there.
Yeah, so you're talking about more rebalancing.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And Kirk, I know you're client-facing. When you're in these meetings with clients, a lot of times you're trying to talk them off the ledge a bit because they don't believe in the market that they're in and they don't see anything positive coming down the road. 2020 seems very scary for a lot of investors.
Yeah, I think 2020 will be an interesting year, actually, with the presidential election, with what's going on in global trade and all that. You know, what I've been hearing, clients not so much, but prospects and people I talk to just kind of out and about, is a lot of people are really afraid of where we are in the cycle. Like, it just seems to be, I haven't found a person who's really aggressive about being invested in the stock market. They're hesitantly invested. They don't want to be. They feel very uncomfortable. They feel like, oh, we're going to have a recession soon. I mean, I don't know. What have they been talking about, the recession, for the last 11 years? We're going to have a recession ever since the last one. I mean, it's just, right. It's a constant thing. And it's hard to say because talking to Meb, I mean, he looks at the CAPE ratio and I want to get both your opinions on this, but you know, you look at that and you could say, well, things are a little bit expensive and how can things keep going higher? But magically they do each year. So I think it's hard to really keep things into perspective, which you kind of have to do if you're a value investor. If you're a growth investor, you don't care. You say, hey, let it ride. I'm on a roll. Let's just keep going. But as a value investor, you have to really be mindful of how can I find good value? And I'm more value tilted as well with mine. I cannot see overpaying for things. I just think that's, I mean, I'm Scott heritage, so I just can't bring myself to overpay. It's really hard to justify some valuations because you're basically taking the standpoint as a momentum investor that it's going to continue to keep going. And it may. You can't know. So you're, in my opinion, you're taking more risk and you're getting more return as a growth investor because you're making an assumption on future growth, which may or may not happen. As a value investor, you're also making some assumptions, but you're doing it from maybe a less risky standpoint. But Barb, what are your thoughts on the CAPE ratio? Because Meb talked about that a little bit, and I know that there's definitely some discrepancies between intellectuals on its worth and different way that it's valued and all that.
Okay, well, like I enjoy doing, first let me just define what the CAPE ratio is. Our standard valuation metric is the price earnings ratio. You take the price of a stock or of a stock market and you divide it by the earnings and you get a number. And then you usually use that number not alone, but you compare it with the history to see is if that number's really high, it indicates that the stock market or an individual stock is probably expensive compared to its historical value. Now, the CAPE ratio attempts to kind of smooth out the fluctuations in profits that occur over different periods of a business cycle. So what the CAPE ratio does in the numerator is you take the share price, just like in the regular PE ratio, but in the denominator, instead of putting the earnings, you take the 10-year average of either a company's earnings or the market in aggregate's earnings and adjust it for inflation. And with the idea that that number is a better representation of the actual value of the asset. Meb mentioned this in his conversation, which was right now our CAPE ratio is trending around 30. The average is somewhere around 15. So you might say, holy, you know, fill in the blank. Let's get out of the stock market. It's double the historical value. Well, that doesn't mean that the valuations aren't going to increase more. By the end of 1999, the CAPE ratio was up around 44. So we're really faced with a conundrum here. Because, first of all, history isn't a guarantee of the future, but it's the only guide we've got. And what Kirk outlined so beautifully is the anxiety that so many investors are feeling, which is we've been in a 10-year plus bull market. It's the longest in recent history. Yeah. And yeah. So everyone is waiting for the other shoe to drop and us to have a market downturn. But on the other hand, we're worried, well, we don't want to miss out on more upside because the market can stay overvalued for long periods of time. So I don't even remember what you asked me, something about the CAPE ratio.
Your opinion of the CAPE ratio, which yes, you're eloquently describing.
I love the CAPE ratio. I look at it all the time and I use it in my own analyses. But investors are in a really tough position now. I mean, what you could do is you could get out of the stock market right now. You could sell all your stocks and take the ginormous capital gains and then watch the market go up another 15% and go, why did I sell all my stocks? Or you could hang in there, watch the market go up, watch the market correct, put more money in, and have the expectation that over the next 10, 15 years, you're better off staying invested, as research has shown. So I prefer the CAPE ratio to the standard PE ratio. I think it's a good indicator that, yeah, the market is overvalued, but that doesn't mean that you should sell. It just means understand that you're paying an awful lot for assets per price, you know, per the price they're trading at right now.
Thanks for that, Barb. That's really good. Megan, what about you? Do you have thoughts on the CAPE ratio?
I mean, I think Barb said it incredibly well. But, you know, it just continues to hit on the point of when you see some of the calculations, it causes concern as an investor. But I think that, as Barb put it, you just have to stay invested. But Kirk, I'm curious about your point of view, because one of the things that came out in the interview is I think you really follow Meb and you do some of these strategies that he does with clients. Is that right?
Yeah. So we have a very tactical approach. So we change our strategy around according to market conditions. But I was using Meb's strategy for quite some time because I do think longer term, if you have somebody who's really focused on long-term investing, then I think the concept of like this show, shareholder yield, is really strong. And I mean, I've looked at the data and I buy into it. I think there's a lot of validity there. I think what Meb has done with his ETF, the shareholder yield ETF is really strong. So I think he's found a good way to create that rules-based approach around the ETF. But I think in general, it's really hard to find good strategies. And if you find a strategy that aligns with your philosophy or your psychology, and you know, we talk about this time to time on the show, but understanding your own investor psychology is really important. Because if you're a momentum investor and you're constantly on edge about markets going up and down, then it may not be the best approach, right? Or if you're aggressive, a value approach may be too boring for you, and you may not stick it out long enough because you can't, you need the action, as I call it. Some people need action, which I think is really detrimental to any investor, you know, treating investing like a casino. But for me, I've done a lot of work on myself, just thinking through and just being mindful of what my own investor psychology is. And I've figured out over the years some things that work and don't work. The strategy I'm using right now incorporates options, which allow me to compensate for some of the weaker areas. I think it was back in 2010 when the markets were, I think they went up or down 10% or more, like 15 or 18 times in 1 year. Like, it was a tremendous amount of volatility, and people who had stop losses kept getting stopped out, and then the market would go back up. So if you kept to a rules-based approach with a stop losses, you would have lost a lot of money that year. In the market, I think, it wasn't a tremendously positive year. I think, I forget where it ended up, but it was mainly doing a lot of whipsaw action. I decided then that approach is not good for me, because if you get stopped out, you have to get back in, and that can be a challenge. So I started using options as a way to bolster that part of me that was having a hard time with it. And it accomplishes the same things. The difference is I don't have to get stopped out. So it solved that problem for me. So I found a solution that works well for me. I still do like the shareholder yield. I think it's challenging as we get into the later stages of this bull market to take a lot of risk. My opinion is the market at this stage could easily see a recession at some point. I think it's going to be inevitable. There will be one at some point. You know, it could be tomorrow. It could be 3 years from now. I mean, who knows? My crystal ball is also not 100% accurate, but we're going to have one. I don't think anybody can deny that. What I find interesting though is the markets could easily go up 20, 30, 50% from here too. Like, that's albeit unlikely, it's also somewhat probable, because if you look at past bull markets, they usually end up with a kind of a run up towards the end. So that's certainly a possibility. So, you know, you have to account for both things. And what I really like about MEB's approach is it takes the emotion out of the investing. I think all of us struggle with that, even the professionals like you, Megan, like me, like Barb. It's a human condition. You know, we have fear and greed as a part of our internal wiring. Everybody listening to the show has the same problem. And the rules-based investing helps remove that human condition, so that you're automating it and that you're not making decisions based on your emotions, but you're making your decisions based on logic. And I think that is one of the things that the rules-based or the quant approach accomplishes. It's something that I think a lot of good quants have found ways to solve. So I guess that's kind of how I look at it. I mean, the shareholder yield concept to me is, it makes a lot of sense. So I don't know have either one of you have read Joel Greenblatt's book, The Little Book That Beats the Market?
No, but I have a client who loves it, and he has given me a copy, so I do need to read it.
Yeah, I mean, he wrote that book and there was one other book, but it's just, he so eloquently like lists out why his strategy works. Like, he puts it in terms that, you know, a sixth grader could understand. And actually, I think the book was written for, it's been a while, but I believe he wrote it for like his kids who were like in sixth grade or something.
He did,
so they could understand it. So it, to me, it's just like somebody who can take extremely complicated formulas and thought process and make it understandable for a sixth grader, to me, that is someone who's well thought out and who really understands it. So I think shareholder yield, and I think Barbara, I want to ask you to kind of lay this out, because I know you're very good at explaining things. You know, from the shareholder yield concept, how do you explain like the formula, just to make sure that the listeners understand?
So, yeah, when I was listening to his conversation, I got the concept. Meb gave a very nice overview of the concept, but the actual formula, the reason that it's used is to help determine the value, again, another valuation ratio to help people determine the payback they're going to get on their investment. We know what a payback is on a bond. You get 2%, 3%, 5%. The shareholder yield attempts to replicate that with the stock. And the formula actually takes the dividends, which we're all very accustomed to using in calculating the yield on a stock. But then it goes beyond that. It adds in the value of net share repurchases. And Meb explained nicely how repurchases of stock increase the value of your personal shares. And it also adds in the net debt pay down of the company. So that's all the numerator. And then it's divided by the market capitalization. And you end up with a percentage. And the higher the percentage, the better value the stock is, and the greater the potential return may be for you.
Barb, yeah. Were you a teacher ever? Because you're amazing at explaining this stuff. Just need one session where you sort of explain all the definitions. I love it.
You're very kind. No, I was a university teacher for a couple of years in investments and finance. So thank you very much. But that's the extent of it.
Yeah, no, it's great.
We'll have a glossary episode here one of these days with just Barb, and we'll just throw terms at her.
Oh, see if she can answer them all.
Oh, great. That's very kind of you. Thank you. Yeah.
So I actually went and pulled one of the first times I'd heard about Meb. He was at a conference and he was giving a presentation. I actually pulled all the old slides. He pulled some data back, and I think it was from 1982 to 2011. So the returns on the S&P 500, according to the data, was like 10.96% for the S&P annualized for those years. The dividend yield returns were like 13.4% for stocks that were focused on highest dividend yield. Stocks that were focused on the repurchase yield was 13.19. Stocks that were focused on debt pay down yield was 13.25. And if you combine all of those, the dividend yield, repurchase yield, the debt pay down yield, it was 15.04%. So that's really why, based on his presentation, that's why he came up with the concept of shareholder yield as an ETF, because if you look at longer term, if you combine them, then it should turn out the better companies. Now, there certainly have been some, I've talked to a lot of people who've come up with other factors that might make this a little bit better. Like, you know, what if you choose companies that are owner-operator companies? So people who have a huge amount of percentage of ownership in their own shares, those typically also outperform companies where the executives don't own shares. But, you know, I guess the more you get into the weeds, you could come up with like 20 or 30 different factors. And I guess the question is, how much of a difference is it actually going to make? You could really go down the rabbit hole with all of this stuff. Personally, I think if you're really going to be a professional investor, then you can do that. But if you have a full-time job, you don't have time to do all this. I mean, people like Meb, Barb, Megan, myself, like, we enjoy this stuff. We enjoy the numbers and the intellectual pursuit of this. But, you know, if you're working a job, you don't want to spend your extra time doing this. You want to spend the extra time with your family and other things you love. So what's most important is just people understand the concept so they know what makes the most sense for them and finding a strategy. And, you know, the one week we don't have Miranda on the show to say, you know, buy and hold, we find a strategy where people can really just not do a whole lot of heavy lifting, I think would be valuable. Megan, any final thoughts on these topics before we wrap it up?
I just want to say, you know, with the quality of guest with Meb, he's someone that the financial community really enjoys and respects. And I think following him, whether it's on Twitter or reading his books, I think helps benefit anyone in understanding sort of the science and the process part of it. And honestly, he's just interesting. in how he looks at this stuff and how he puts it together. So I think my final thoughts are, this is a great guest to, you know, go start following on Twitter and sign up for his letters and so on.
Yeah, he's got a thing he does, the Idea Farm, where he actually sends out other people's research. So I highly recommend people look into that, because he pulls together a bunch of research from a variety of sources, from the big investment banks, from independent researchers, and just kind of sends out the best parts. So it actually helps reduce your reading if you enjoy this stuff like we do. It reduces your reading time to just focus on the stuff that are curated by someone who knows a little bit more than most. So where can people find more about you, Megan?
Sure. You can find me at Wealth Intersect on Twitter and at thewealthintersection.com. And feel free to email me at megan@thewealthintersection.com.
Great. And Barb, final words from you and final thoughts.
Yeah, I echo what Megan said. I think this guy's the real deal. He's very interesting. He's very smart. We've got a lot to learn from him. And I do just want to add something, because as we were talking, I pulled up a comparison for the past 5 years of the S&P 500 returns with his shareholder yield ETF, which is SYLD is the ticker symbol. And over the last 5 years, the S&P 500 earned 13.2% annualized, while the shareholder yield his shareholder yield fund earned 15.5%. Now, again, this is only 5 years, so don't everybody rush out and go buy it today. But I think that's pretty interesting data in support, at least short-term support for this approach. Obviously, you need more years of data to really determine a valuable strategy. I thought that was interesting. And then I just want to throw in one more investing piece. Like Kirk said, you don't have to do a lot of buying and selling and whatever. Meb mentioned owning a robo-advisor. There are free and very cheap robo-advisors. If you just want to set it and forget it and let someone else manage your money for you, robo-advisors invest according to pretty good academic research, and their returns really fall in line with the market, which is what most investors want. So anyhow, you can find me online. My name is Barbara Friedberg, and I actually do own and run RoboAdvisor Pros, which is a website devoted to reviewing and researching those automated investment advisors. So thanks for having me on again, Kirk. And I apologize for the little self-promo.
No apologies necessary, Barb.
You're used to it, right?
Hey, we all have to do a little of that. That's fine. Yeah. So no, I appreciate you both being on the show. I think this is great. I enjoyed the interview with Meb and hope to have him on the show again. I know he has a big interest in farmland too, which I certainly share. And I'm trying to get some really good guests on the show to talk about farmland, because that's something that, talking about value, it's one of the few areas of the market where I, you know, there's potential value. You know, it's definitely in the value camp of underperforming for the last decade or so. But anyway, so my name's Kirk Chisholm, wealth manager at Innovate Advisory Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find out more about me at innovativewealth.com. And of course, you can find me every week here on the show. Thank you again for joining us at Money Tree Investing Podcast. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Play. You can also check out our show at moneytreepodcast.com. On our website, you'll have access to all our resources, show notes, as well as some archive shows. Lastly, please leave a show rating as well as some comments for the podcast app of your choice. When you subscribe and rate the show, it allows us to get better access to some of the top guests you're going to want to hear. We actually have quite a few guests coming up, which I'm really excited to bring to all of you. We're really starting to get a lot of high quality guests like Meb because of the show and because of you and your support of the show. So have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.